This is 88.9 FM, Neighborhood Public Radio. You're listening to Frank Prattle. My name is Zephyr, and I have an extra special guest on today, the filmmaker Jim Cohen.
Jim?
I almost blew it. Right out of the gate.
Okay.
Hi, Jim.
Hello.
So you're in San Francisco right now, from your hometown of New York now? Is that where you live?
That's where I live. It's not my hometown.
Okay.
But it's where I live.
And you're in town with SF Camera Work right now, screening a film, your new film called Chain, right?
Yeah, it's not new anymore, but we can pretend.
Let's pretend.
Okay. No, I'm screening at SF Camera Work, and that's really the main reason that I'm here, but I also have some other gigs lined up this week at Yerba Buena and ATA Other Cinema.
It's what are you showing at Yerba Buena?
Well, that is a new one. That's a new one called Building a Broken Mousetrap, which is a new, well, it's primarily a concert film of a Dutch band called The X. And but it's also a little bit of a city film and a little bit of a protest film. So it's those things mixed up together, but the heart of it is a very fierce performance that the X gave one night in New York.
This isn't the old band X.
This is not X. This
from
is
X
the
Survaca.
The
X.
EX. Yeah, and they're the old band too, because they've been around for 27 years.
Wow.
But it's a different thing.
Different old
than
band.
The LA band.
So one.
Sorry. Oh, so I'm showing that and maybe a short or two at Yerba Buena, and I am also doing a gig at Other Cinema where I will show an earlier piece called Buried in Light, which is a series of Central and Eastern European portraits shot in Super 8 in the early 90s after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and then I'll show a bunch of other stuff from the grab bag music things, Elliot Smith portrait, Sparkle Horse portrait, and some 16mm that I used to show out on the road with Godspeed You Black Emperor, and who knows what else will happen at Other Cinema, because it's one of those places where you feel inspired to be a little free.
You might even bust out the Jefferson Airplane footage you shot.
That's right. Last time I was there, I didn't bust the Jefferson Airplane, but I busted out the Butthole Surfers I-Beam 1986 footage.
Ooh, very nice.
Yeah.
So a question I had for you about film is, do you still enjoy film?
As opposed to video or
no,
as
a medium?
Do I enjoy film?
Do you enjoy going to the movies still?
You know, I wish I could just say, well, of course I do. I love the movies. But I don't go to the movies very often.
How often would you say?
I would say I go maybe once every couple of months, or once, yeah, something like, maybe once a month.
Okay.
Once a month, yeah. If I sometimes I go to a film festival and jam it all in and see a whole ton of them.
Right.
Because it's free. And I can sneak out the back if they don't work for me.
Right.
But when I shell out 10, 50, and it doesn't work for me, then I don't feel like walking out, but I just feel bad.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a complicated question and answer, because I love the movies. I love motion pictures, particularly projected film. But I don't go see very many new movies, and I feel pretty let down by the whole Hollywood racket. But I go see movies at Anthology Film Archives or the IFC Center, or sometimes shows good stuff now, and you know, Film Forum, the more independent or art film or kind of joints. I don't really go to the regular movies very often at all.
Right.
You know.
But that not answering the question.
Oh, do I
enjoy.
Enjoy it.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, if it's the right show, there's nothing like it. It can blow your mind, you know. A couple of weeks ago I saw a short by a Canadian guy, Arthur Lipsett, that I'd never seen his work, and some of my Montreal musician friends turned me on to him, and I saw this little short, and it was just so crazy and beautiful and kind of weird that I didn't know of it. It was done in the 70s, I think, and you just never know when you're going to get a little bolt out of the blue, and then you feel really kind of reawakened to your love of the movies. But a lot of times when I go see, a lot of the more slick, big actor-y kind of extravaganzas, I just feel kind of alienated from the stuff itself, you know.
Right. The reason I ask is that, you know, I know a lot of times when people have had fairly long careers and they've been making, you know, movies or, you know, whatever the hell it is they make, that sometimes they can lose some of that original vision they had, but they kind of pick it up in other ways. Who would you say has been most influential recently in your own filmmaking?
Recently?
Or in your own life, actually, you know, not just filmmaking.
Right. Well, the influential one is tough because there are things that I love, but I don't know if I can say that they're directly influential. I've loved Abbas Kiarostami's films for a while now. Like, I'm always excited that there's a new Kiarostami. I really love the Dardennes, the Belgian brothers. You know, and then there's a lot of old stuff that I love. But I get more kicks, I think, from music usually, as far as kind of direct inspiration. Or I like when I go to see certain kinds of show, music, concert experiences, I find it kind of sets my mind spinning about films that I wish I was making or wish I could make. That tends to happen to me a little bit more somehow with music, or maybe like going to see some old paintings or something like that, than it does so much in the cinema.
Right.
I'm not sure why that is, but that's just the way it is.
You have pretty varied background as far as musical taste, though, too. I mean, from, you know, as
sure.
You said, like Butthole Surfers to Fugazi to, you know, Elliot Smith and
I
other
worked
stuff.
With Terry Riley a bit this last couple of years, and I listened to a lot of so-called classical music. I listened to a lot of crazy stuff from all around the world. Been listening to some beautiful Ethiopian music and some. What else am I listening to? I break for Willie Nelson. I love Willie Nelson. I love.
What's your favorite Willie Nelson song? Because I love Willie Nelson is the only musician that me and my grandmother agree on.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's good because Willie is the bridge.
He is.
Between he's the only thing maybe in the country that everybody can really probably agree on, because you've got the like right wing kind of conservative backwoods people, and they can enjoy Willie along with their pot smoking neighbor,
right?
And they can enjoy it with their Rastafarian friends, since Willie is kind of a Rastafarian, I've always thought. Willie is a great treasure. What's my favorite Willie Nelson song? That is a real tough one.
We didn't say it'd be easy.
No. There's... Wow. I might have to think about that as the interview goes,
yeah.
And then at the end it might come to me. Lately, I've been really kind of bowled over by this song of his. I can't remember the name of it, though. It's on the IRS record that I bought. There was a point in which the IRS took all Willie's stuff, and late night television had these ads where you could help bail Willie out by ordering the record. It was the most incredible thing. It's the only time I've ever dialed an 800 number from a late night TV ad, because I was trying to A, help Willie out with the IRS, and B, get all these crazy tracks that you couldn't get otherwise. And it was called like the IRS record, but there's a song on it that the lyric is like, this is Jimmy's it's an anti-war song of the most intense variety. It's really heavy. It's like talking about, you know, this is Jimmy's this and this is Jimmy's that, and then, you know, eventually you realize that Jimmy is, like, you know, dead from some war, and it's quite extraordinary. You know, it's like, this is Jimmy's grouse where Jimmy likes to lay around. That's really good. So yeah, Willie's an inspiration among other things, but yeah, I do, you know, there's just, sometimes when you're young and being difficult, you like to pretend you don't like all kinds of music, and then you think you'll never be one of those people who's like, oh, I like it all.
Right.
I even listen to opera, you know. But I have to say, yeah, I listen to a lot, you know, John Coltrane, there's no greater inspiration than Coltrane. Been listening to a lot of Coltrane. And
what do you think about Mingus?
I'm just getting into Mingus. Mingus is just opening up to me right now.
Uh-huh.
You know, and it's kind of, yeah, he's definitely blowing my mind.
Black
Who,
Saint
I,
and the Sinner Lady, that album, that one destroys me.
I'm gonna write that down here, radio people, here's the pen. Click. All right, Black what?
Black Saint and Sinner Lady.
Did you all get that? Everybody get your
everyone out there.
Out? All right.
Run.
I don't know if you can still get the IRS Willie record with that Jimmy song on it, but particularly that kind of middle period Willie's really incredible.
Well,
all right.
Another question I had for you is, I hear rumor, and this might be, you know, untrue, so correct me if it's wrong,
right,
that you shoot only with 16 millimeters.
That's not true.
Is it not true?
No.
You shoot mostly with 16 millimeter.
I shoot a lot of Super 8 still, and I shoot a lot of 16, and I shoot video now as well.
Do you shoot digital video?
Yeah, sure. You got to shoot what you got at hand, you know.
Okay.
My heart is mostly with film, 16 and Super 8 equally, but sometimes videos is good. It's a different thing. All the tools in the toolbox. Some of the tools are much more of a pleasure to reach into the toolbox and hold in the hand, like a Bolex versus a video camera.
Right.
But, you know, we must roll with the punches.
Understood. What did you shoot your new movie Chain on?
Chain is all 16 millimeter, except that there's like a video diary in it that one of the characters keeps, and that's DV.
Okay. What? Now I watched Chain, and I gotta be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
It dragged me down to the dark place, in the best possible
Come
way.
Come on, it's a comedy too. It is.
But there was something so chilling about the constant, constant changing yet similarity of landscape.
Right.
That really brought the ice into my heart. You care to elaborate a little bit about what you were shooting for? Or?
Sure. I mean, what I usually say about Chain is that a lot of my work was based in shooting in places where there was some very distinctive regional character that I was interested in preserving. And so a lot of work that I did was in places like, you know, Krakow or Budapest or Sicily, or, you know, just places that I traveled, and I loved the places for being distinctive. And but as I did that over the years, I increasingly had to frame out encroachments of fast food joints or new hotels or corporate headquarters or in industrial parks and theme parks and all of the kind of peripheral attachments that they tend to bring in as they invade. And so I realized after a while that I could travel most anywhere and not really be able to necessarily tell where I was anymore. And I also realized that even though I found that to be a pretty disturbing trend, I felt like it was something that maybe I should try to attend to in my work. And so after framing all that stuff out for quite a while, I started to just really focus on it, and I wanted to look at those places as carefully as I could.
And do you think, I mean, what are your own personal, I mean, you don't obviously don't have to talk about this if you don't want to,
right,
as with all the questions, but what are your own personal feelings on the similarities between those two? Now, I've heard you quoted as saying, I didn't really take one stance or the other as far as showing.
Well, I take a stance in my personal life, but I didn't want to take that stance in a direct way in the film, because, you know, there's a sort of I mean, I don't know too many people who are like, oh great, they're putting in a new Gap and they just knocked down that nice old warehouse and I'm psyched that there's going to be a mega mall there. I mean, I don't, you know, it's pretty hard to feel good about that kind of phenomena. But the sort of, you know, kind of obvious reaction of just being appalled or horrified or wishing it would somehow stop is not where I wanted to go with my filmmaking, because I wouldn't want to make a film that just kind of hammered away at a sort of set agenda. And I think that when you take that kind of approach in your filmmaking, where you sort of make up your mind about something and then hammer away at it and expect everybody else to sort of enjoy the head nodding in a, you know, in agreement, I think that's just kind of can be very limiting. I mean, sometimes work can be done that way and should be done that way, but I wanted to see if I could make a movie where the foreground goal was to look carefully and not to tell people how to think about certain subjects. And so the primary thing for me was to suggest that we look at a phenomena and a kind of geography which is strangely invisible to us, even though it's everywhere. Because you really, I found that I don't even really like register what these places look like. I mean, they're just kind of abstractions, except that suddenly they're not. They've taken over like some whole vista that you used to look at and see a bunch of old houses or, you know, or a field or some railroad tracks. And I wanted to kind of question that invisibility by forcing people to look long and hard at something that maybe they just didn't bother to look at. Because I feel that, you know, whatever you feel about these issues, you have to start by seriously looking, you know?
Right.
And so that was the starting point for me. That said, it would be foolish for me to pretend that like I'm okay with this stuff and that I'm just an objective observer and that's what the film is there for. No, I mean, the film feels different to different people. Some people are mad at me because I'm not sort of clearly expressing my distaste for these places and this phenomena. And other people feel like it's a film like full of rage and that it's thinly veiled. And I think both of those are kind of interesting reactions, but I'm glad that I've had both of those reactions rather than just everybody saying like, oh, I saw the film you made about how you hate malls, you know, or how malls, because, you know, I just don't need to preach to the converted in that way.
Right.
So, but anyway, I also wanted to make a movie that addressed some of these issues through characters, through people who are not necessarily critical and of these places or of these changes, and they don't really have the means to be, because everybody doesn't have those means. I mean, everybody didn't you know, everybody didn't have parents who hated Walt Disney, like thankfully mine did, you know. And everybody doesn't go to liberal arts universities where you take courses and talk about globalization and its problems. I wanted to think about how people were navigating these spaces who were just stuck in them and just had to make the best that they could of it. So I tried to do that non-judgmentally to a degree.
Right.
I don't think that too many people would watch the whole thing and say that it's a positive, upbeat look at trends in franchising and the coming giant theme park of the world. But so, you know, it was kind of a balancing act, and people
right.
have to make up their own minds about whether they feel I pulled that off.
Yeah. One of the scenes that particularly struck me about the movie was in the abandoned mall, or soon to be abandoned mall, the drugstore that they were doing inventory on, that a woman
right.
was doing inventory on and had brought her children in
right.
to kind of run rampant, and then began giving away the goods as well.
Yeah.
That's tell me a little bit about that. I mean, that was a stunning scene.
Well, it was a strange thing. I was shooting, and I pulled over because I saw that there was a mall that was being torn down, and thinking I would immediately get busted, I just got out the camera and started to move into this kind of wrecked space, and I found that I wasn't getting, no one was stopping me, so I kept just moving farther into it, and it was very strange and very spooky, and you know, most of it was just being torn down, and it's fascinating to see this kind of cross section of these spaces, because you can see how, like, literally the walls between these stores are like an inch and a half thick, and all of the materials are so incredibly cheap, and so, you know, they come down pretty easy.
Right.
But I was, I actually, you know, went into the part that was still had a roof on top, and then as I moved further in shooting, I saw that the Eckerd's drugstore had lights on, and I got closer and I saw that there were people in it. And so yeah, it was just very strange. But that's one of the things that fascinated me, is this whole business about how you often kind of can't tell whether these kinds of structures are coming down or going up, and there's this
right.
planned obsolescence in the way that they're made, so that you know, even though they're predicated on this idea of like being eternally new, they're often built so poorly that they're kind of shabby and tattered around the edges, and then they pull them down. And in this case, they were wrecking that mall because they were building a much bigger, newer mall right across the highway.
Right.
And so the new mall had won and beaten down the old mall, and
mall victory
was at hand. So yeah, it was very strange, spooky moment.
One of the things, another thing actually that I noticed in the movie was that it was almost as if it was a true documentary at first. It took me a while to figure out that they were indeed actresses.
Wait a minute, fella.
Yeah.
No, actually, that's not exactly true.
For myself, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, but it is a documentary.
It is, but they are actresses as well.
No, not really.
No? Okay, tell me.
No, people have. That's why people should go see it, so that they can work that out on their own.
Okay.
Yeah, but I can definitely tell you that one of the main people in it is not an actress.
So okay.
Two main people in it.
Right. All right. You don't care to elaborate on that anymore?
No, because I think that, you know, I was trying to work in a territory that's really between documentary and narrative, and there's a lot of slippage in between those two things, and I think it's really nice if people go without setting that up too clearly in their minds.
Right.
And so I've always stated that it's a narrative feature, it's a documentary, and it's a political film. You know, it's
okay.
three things at the same time.
Tell me a little bit, moving on though, about how much you travel. I mean, you travel a lot.
Well, I do.
How many locations was it shot in?
Well, it's shot in hundreds and hundreds of locations. I don't know how many countries, but a few. I mean,
Easily, like over, what, as far as cities wide, over 15?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. Well, I was really struck by the fact that I could go anywhere and work on it, because every place has a mall and every place has some sort of corporate presence that's so increasingly dominant that the spaces become, you can connect them together like Legos.
Right.
And so, truth is, I could have just shot the whole thing in Jersey and it wouldn't really look much different. But I was kind of obsessed with the fact that, you know, I could put shots together from all over and not shoot all in Jersey.
Right.
And that's part of the form and function of the movie, you know, was to make that point, almost by making that point invisible.
Do you want to talk a little bit about kind of some of the role reversal that goes on between the two actresses?
Characters, you mean.
Characters, sorry. Characters.
The stories that the movie tells involve a young drifter who leaves home due to some sort of credit card problem and sort of takes off across country and then ends up living illegally on the sort of fringes of a shopping mall and living off of the shopping mall, basically. And then the other character who is seen in kind of parallel is a Japanese executive who is sent out by her home corporation to study the world of theme parks and kind of entertainment complexes, because the steel factory in Japan that she is connected to is going to be converted to a theme park.
Right.
So those two characters are the people that I became fascinated with, and kind of the movie travels with them, and it's I tried to just be straight up about what their lives are like.
Have you yourself ever done any squatting? Because it seemed fairly realistic.
No, I haven't done any in the literal sense. I mean, I spent some time at squats here and there. Sometimes that's where I do my gigs, you know, screening films and stuff, particularly in Europe. And I think it's an interesting kind of important phenomena, but yeah, not one that I've personally undertaken.
Okay. And so in this movie, I don't know if you want to elaborate on that,
yeah,
or if you want to save that.
No, I just don't like to tell too much about what happens in
okay.
the movie or how it was done and all that, because a lot of times, people will assume that this person is acting or whatever, and sometimes they're wrong.
No, not a problem. What do you? I mean, something I always wonder about creative people, be it filmmakers, photographers, anyone, artist wise, what have you.
Right.
What happens when you reach a block? How do you unblock yourself? Or how does that happen?
There's a great quote that I pulled out of a New Yorker article talking about someone who was involved in some sort of some field that I had no particular interest in. So that's somebody who wrote what did he do? Pop music in the 40s and 50s. But he said something about listen, wait, and obey as a kind of directive for artists, in terms of that there are times when you just have to kind of, drift a little bit and wait for something to happen, and then when it comes, you just have to follow it. And I think that that's pretty good advice. There are plenty of times where I get stuck in a project, and many of my projects are constructed over long periods of time. Chain, 7 years. Benjamin Smoke, 10. The Fugazi film, Instrument, 10. Of course, these are overlapping projects because I'm not that old, but they're, I will shoot and then wait and think and shoot a little bit more, and I don't function in the way that most normal movie makers function, in terms of having a production schedule and a big crew, and you kind of have to make the movie
in 2 weeks or else.
Yeah, I don't generally work that way. So once in a blue moon I get lucky and something happens in 3 days, or in the case of the X film, the bulk of the film is made in one night. But generally speaking, you run into situations where you are at sea and you have to work your way through it. And often, in my case, sifting through the material is where you get the answers. And the real world often comes along and tells you what you should do. I often work kind of backwards by shooting, and then I find things in the footage that are indicators of what I'm trying to make.
So subconsciously there's a movie inside you that is shooting itself, and then you kind of carve it out later?
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate in a way. That's one way you could describe some of what happens.
What are you working on in the future? What are some plans that you've got?
Well, I'm slowly working on a big Times Square 42nd Street project that's from a kind of 20-year archive of shooting that area. I was mostly shooting there in the late 80s, mid-late 80s and early 90s, but I kept it up, and I will make something out of all that material, and I don't know what it will be yet. I have a recent short film that's a portrait of an artist named Anne Truitt, who I became friends with. And I have another unreleased short that I'm finishing up that's kind of has something to do with war, America's fondness for
smashing things.
Yeah, it's just sort of built around it. A guy I ran into on the street who was a veteran of a number of these difficult visits to other countries. Let's see, I'm trying to think if there's anything else going on. I've been doing something a little different. I've been helping to make a Vic Chestnut record happen with a bunch of musicians that I thought he should be playing with, that it would be interesting to get them together. I'm not really a record producer, but I've been working on that. I think it's a pretty interesting record.
When's it come out?
Sometime this year. It looks like it's going to happen.
Sounds
I mean,
good.
It's made, but it's not finished.
So as far as San Francisco, have you ever shot any footage in this town?
There's a little bit of San Francisco in chain, a couple of shots.
Is there?
Popped up, yeah.
I'm sorry, I couldn't pick it out.
There's actually one real distinctive one that's a very particular, odd building that you have here. But let's see, what else did I shoot? I shot something coming down some nearby foresty road in the heavy fog in the mid 1980s. Did a little film, black and white Super 8 thing. I haven't shot much in San Francisco.
No. Have you been shooting since you've been here?
No, I wasn't going to shoot, and I didn't bring a movie camera or anything, and then I started.
And you got that
jonesing
itch.
And now I've borrowed a Polaroid camera. Because, it's one of the things that, one of those problems that some of us have is we just keep wanting to take pictures of things.
Compulsive documentation.
Yep. As habits go, I guess there are more destructive ones than that.
I'll say.
Yeah. But, you know.
What do you feel about the differences between showing at a place like here, like SF Camera Work, versus showing in kind of more theater-oriented, you know?
Right. Well,
house?
You know, in a perfect world, I think it was really made for movie theaters and get a bunch of people in a dark room and hit them with it as hard as you can, you know. But we don't live in that perfect world, and these people were kind enough to express interest, and I was initially hesitant because I don't usually show in galleries and it's in a kind of an unusual setup for the film, but I liked their attitude and I liked their spirit and I liked their genuine interest and attention that they gave it, and so I think it's been a good experiment, and I'm just happy that they took it on. You know, they had the guts to do it. I mean, it would be great if it was in the multiplex, because then it would really, a lot of film festivals now take place in commercial,
right,
you know, situations, often in a shopping mall, and let me tell you, having people walk out of this film into the mall is really nice, you know, it's really troubling.
It's almost seamless.
It's almost seamless, yeah, and it freaks people out. So I really enjoyed that where I've been able to do it. But I didn't, you know, this is, we're in a period where you don't find distributors who really have the wherewithal or the guts to show really kind of different kinds of movies. And so I don't think it's going to be playing in the multiplex, sadly.
Do you think that'll ever change? I mean, I wonder about that on a personal level for myself as well. Like, you know, you hear people talking about like the shortened attention span of America, and you know, this kind of massive conglomerate capitalism greed that turns out Disney hits after Disney hits. Do you foresee any change in that in the future, in a direction more favorable to, say, you know, movies like you make?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not prone to great bouts of optimism on these subjects. It's always been hard to find places to show stuff. But every once in a while, something comes out of the blue, and you just go figure. I mean, that movie Old Joy is the kind of movie that everybody would say is like not distributable and that nobody would touch it, and it's done quite well, and it's popped up in all kinds of places, and it's a very quiet, kind of non-Disney, non-action film, and it's interesting to me that that has had its day. So you never know, and none of us should give up, but it is something that we have to kind of, I think it's increasingly important for people to sort of vote with their feet and with their wallet, and when people have a decision to make about whether they're going to go see, I understand there's a sort of level of like kind of kitschy fun that attends like going to see, you know, Tom Cruise in MI7 or whatever it is. It's not like it's a sin for people to want a certain kind of like tacky pleasure of watching these people blow things up on the scale which only they can. But I also increasingly feel like don't give that shit your money. You know, go to see if you're in this area, you've got the Pacific Film Archive showing incredible stuff all the time. You've got a bunch of interesting different places. You got other cinema where, you know, anything can happen and often will. And, you know, it's just really important to stand up and be counted, because it's really, really hard for those places to keep going when people take them for granted.
Right.
And so I feel strongly about that. And, you know, I don't, going to say I don't despair, but that's not true. I frequently despair, but I don't give up hope. I mean, it's just like anything else, you know, there's a lot of bad music, and there's a lot of bad top 40, and there's a lot of Clear Channel, you know, taking over this and that, but then other things pop up. You all can go see Vic Chestnut. He's playing, I think, in a week or so, part of some extravaganza festival shenanigans here, and Vic is extraordinary, should be seen by those who haven't seen him. See Vic Chestnut. So yeah, things are always coming up and popping up, and there's always great bands coming out of the woodwork and interesting movies, and you just, sometimes you have to work a little harder to seek them out and make sure that they have they get a little shot, you know, that they get a little chance.
Right.
So, get on out there, folks.
Along those lines, I was wondering what perhaps some advice that you would have. I mean, you've been making films for a while now. Advice you'd have for new filmmakers?
Well, I think the first advice that I usually give is for people to to turn off the TV, spend less time on the internet. I think that, you know, we are, it's very hard for people not to feel kind of inundated with good and bad and information, and pop culture is, you know, it's like just when you think the parody has reached a level of complete, total Michael Jackson freak out, then, you know, suddenly it hits some other level. I just, you know, the other day I'm walking down the street and there's like a little tiny headline in the corner that says, like, you know, Obama announces candidacy, and then this giant headline underneath it of like Britney in rehab or whatever it was, or no, it was Anna Nicole Smith dying, and it was just like, it was like a sight gag of the kind that seems rather heavy-handed, except it also happens to be part of our reality, you know, that you see that in a newspaper. I don't know that I'm so, you know, struck that Obama is going to save us. I doubt it, but nonetheless, it's a little more important than Anna Nicole Smith, I think. Fair to say. So anyway, my advice in terms of like young people and trying to make movies is to clear some of the clutter, like, rather than watching a bunch of incredibly kind of, you know, quote unquote, like, creative cutting edge TV commercials. I think it's just great to just step out of that realm of constant, like, sort of forced newness and spectacle and just the sort of barrage of recycling and appropriation and referencing. I think it's nice for people to just kind of try to clear their minds a little bit. So I do recommend turning that stuff off rather than kind of constantly feeling the need to sort of stay on top of it, or because it's so dominant in the culture, like, you feel like you kind of have to play the game by commenting on it or making work about it or whatever. You know, I think it's important to remember that you can also, like, walk away. So I recommend that. Another thing that I recommend is, I think we live in a culture where a lot of young people in art or filmmaking or whatever they're getting into, or music, they have certain, they're also kind of bombarded with stardom and celebrity as a kind of constant possibility. And particularly, you know, the possibility that they could suddenly be on a bunch of magazine covers and, you know, go into fancy restaurants and, like, you know, selling work for 500 grand at the Miami Art Fair or whatever. And again, it's like, that's a very, I think that's a pretty problematic thing to hang over people's heads, you know, to have that as some sort of expectation or promise or thing that you're going to feel like a failure if you don't achieve that, like so-and-so over there did,
right,
you know, in their
right
first show out of grad school or whatever. So I think that people need to kind of be reminded that there are quiet, long-standing traditions of artists sort of plugging away at things, and, you know, there's real interesting examples where Goya is doing some of his very best work at the end of his life, and Wallace Stevens is working in the insurance company and writing his weird poems. And, you know, I just saw a great show by an artist, June Leaf, who's in her late 70s. My friend Anne Truitt was in her 80s when she died, and doing some very, you know, important work. And all that kind of thing, I think it's important to keep that tradition in mind. And part of that tradition is a different set of expectations and a possibility that there can be a community of people who are not so desperate to like hit it big and hit it quick, you know. And I just think it's strange that so much of our museums are filled with the work of artists who are now so canonized, and yet the behavior that surrounds like a lot of art openings or a lot of like blockbuster shows seems to completely eradicate the actuality that when a lot of these artists were working, they were ignored or they were poor or they were kind of hashing things out in a context where it never occurred to them that they would, that, you know, being on magazine covers or whatever just wasn't part of what they were struggling with, you know. And so I think that young artists should keep that in mind, you know, that there has always been another tradition, another way of working, and sometimes part of that means that you don't have a lot of dough, and that's okay. You know, it's a pretty simple thing, but it's a good thing for people to be reminded of. Let's see, what else do I tell? I think that we're in a climate where I don't ever think that artists have to make political art, or, you know, I would really bristle at the notion that, you know, every artist has to do work about any particular topic or in any kind of form. And yet, as humans, it increasingly seems apparent that if we don't get it together and have some changes made, then, you know, things can get so ugly and so hair-raising that we're just not even going to have the luxury of thinking about our art when, you know, if the country does something so insane and misbegotten as to enter into another war on top of the ones that we've already got that are already disasters, and if we were to allow that as a society, the situation with Iran, I think that as a culture, if we were to somehow acquiesce and allow that to happen, that we would allow this administration to do something that stupid, that would invite hundreds of years of horrible conflict in that part of the world, and then probably in our part of the world. I think that we have to attend to things like that, even if they're not our things that really interest us. It doesn't mean we have to make everybody has to make their artwork about it, but I do sometimes feel like we have to make some changes collectively, and it is just reaching a point of kind of no return, you know. Maybe that's a little bit delusional, but I made a film that has to do with a certain kind of globalization. It wasn't meant to be a film just about America, but there is a degree to which I was curious. In the course of making Chain, I kept hearing, you know, these comments about exporting democracy, and part of the thing that I was trying to get at was when certain people talk about exporting democracy, I think that what they're actually talking about is exporting a certain kind of commerce with a kind of full-on capacity for altering landscapes outside of our own country, and their notion of democracy has nothing to do with people voting or people not voting or whether people can, you know, speak freely in the newspaper. It has to do with the ability of certain corporations to sell things at a massive scale anywhere they want, and to alter the landscape in any way that they want. And so that, to me, was something important to look at, is that when they talk about democracy, are they talking about a theoretical construct that has to do with the words of the people who wrote the Constitution, or are they talking about Halliburton and Halliburton having certain freedoms? So, you know, I mean, that all sounds a little bit, I don't know, I mean, I sound like I'm on a little soapboxy rant here. Sorry, but that's often, you know, that's the stuff that I feel is...
Well, I think that's the important stuff, you know, you're addressing what you actually care about.
Well, yeah, I mean, I still do feel, I often try to make an argument, like, against propaganda as a sort of primary mode of art making, because I feel partly that it just inherently has certain limitations, and it also, if you kind of create propaganda for your side, and then it tends to be answered with propaganda from the other side, and you get in kind of a propaganda war, and I don't know how productive or interesting those are, although occasionally I see some propaganda that's like so powerful that I have to kind of question my own thinking about that. Oh, something buzzing. But anyway, I don't know, I feel like I'm rambling a little bit. I wish I could be more concise about this stuff. It just, I guess what I'm trying to express is that I'm trying to make these odd films that are in a way very accessible, because they're addressing the world that we live in, and they're addressing the things that we all see and that we all encounter. And so on a certain level, I just don't think that they're that fringe or strange or experimental or any of the other kind of categories that they often get shoved into. And in my own work, I do feel that sometimes I have felt a sort of surprising urgency to deal with some issues that I never thought I would be dealing with, that I never thought I would be so driven to kind of take on. And I didn't, probably if you had asked me 15 years ago, you know, are you a political filmmaker, I would have kind of said, no, you know, not really. But now I'll just say, yeah, I am, you know, I believe in that.
Well, excellent. Thank you so much, Jim.
Well, all right.
This is...
Yakety yak.
This is 88.9 FM, Neighborhood Public Radio. My name is Zephyr, and you've been listening to Frank Prattle. We've had Jim Cohen, international filmmaker, on with us today, who just leveled with us about some pretty damn heavy shit. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.